I'd like to think that I'm being altruistic by putting myself on the first day, proposing a problem that you might want to work on. Is there a way to focus?
Yes.
You're right.
Yes.
Focus on that.
Peter, do you know the way to focus?
Squint.
Constructive proof and an existence proof, right? Let's see. There's buttons. Buttons. Where are the buttons?
There are buttons here. Image rotate auto, yeah. Where are the buttons? One of you guys, could you come tell me how to focus this thing?
Speaking to the cloud.
I'm speaking to.
It's TV.
It's not focusing. For instance, Apple being salty.
Yeah. Symphony looks pretty good.
Symphony looks bad.
So.
Well, the bull in the china shop.
No, that's.
Glad you waited for
the bull in the china shop. China, better.
And the projection is off there.
Thank you. Alex was saying. It's not real great.
How small is your font when you're Yeah, I think can everybody read the bottom?
Well, I think you can read it. It's just a little fuzzy.
Now is it focus?
Yes.
Yeah. So the
problem. It'll probably work. It's been better than the past.
Okay.
I think.
Maybe your slides are wearing out.
This is a problem when you use slides for 5 years. Okay, so as I said, I took a certain liberty because I want to propose a problem to you. And the problem is one that was proposed to me originally by Carlton Caves in 1999, when many of us were at Cambridge. And he walked into the office one day and he said that, suppose you have a d-dimensional Hilbert space. Do you think, this is the way Carl put it, do you think you can find d-squared projection operators, one-dimensional projection operators, such that the trace of the product of any two of these projection operators, is equal to a constant?
A different constant if they're the same.
A different constant if they're the same. So this is for I not equal to j. Yeah. The constant if they're the same is 1. And he said that he knew that you could do it in dimension 2, because you draw the block sphere, and you choose any regular tetrahedron on the block sphere, and that corresponds to a set of 4 states with this nice inner product property. And so his question was, do you think you can do it in other dimensions? And I said, well, I don't know. So we walked down the hallway to Wouters. Oh, I should mention that Zauner had independently proposed this question, and it appeared in print in the same year. We walked to Wouters' office, and we told him what we knew. We knew about dimension 2. And Bill said, oh, I think that I can find a set in dimension 3. And so in the way that Bill does, as many of you know, he just wrote down the first set of these guys pretty quickly and said they should have the right properties. And they did. And then I think this set 2 might have been first proposed by Robin Blum Kahout down over there. So they exist in dimension 2 and they exist in dimension 3, a set of projection operators with equal inner products. And since then, we've learned some things. We've learned that they exist in more dimensions than that. They at least exist in dimension 2 through 13, 15, and 19. And there's numerical evidence, again from Robin Blum Kahout, that makes it appear that they exist in dimensions at least up to 47. This might seem like a measly addition to our knowledge, since this question
was first proposed in 1999, but it's not because people haven't been trying. There's been a significant amount of effort in trying to show the existence of these things, or to try to find a counterexample to the existence. I think there's something like 10 papers now properly addressing the question of existence. And as you see from some of the titles, some of the papers have had to get very specific. For instance, Grossel here wrote a paper on Sikh POVMs and MUBs in dimension 6, and that made a whole paper. So there's been some published work, and there's also been now a lot of activity here at PI in the last 10 months, because almost everyone who walks through the doors of this place, if they look like they might have an interest in the problem, I accost them and try to get them to think about it. And here and there, bits and pieces of progress have been made. But the overall question of whether these things exist in all dimensions remains not very far from where it was when it was first posed. So this is the question on my mind. Can one show that this structure in Hilbert space exists in arbitrary dimensions? Now, sadly, it's been the case that as it has become clear, more clear, that the problem is a difficult problem mathematically, I have become more and more convinced that the structure is so nice and so pretty that even if they don't exist in all dimensions, they should exist in all dimensions. And that's really what this talk is going to be about, why they should exist. What, Charlie?
Ask about the interdimensional analog of it?
I wonder, and Alexander Volovo asked that yesterday, whether you might take d equal to infinity and so make sense of this concept. And I don't have a good answer for whether it does or whether it doesn't. I mean, on the one hand, as I'll show you later, the constant is such that as you take d equal to infinity, the constant goes to zero. So they look like they're becoming more and more orthogonal. On the other hand, you're demanding that you have an overcomplete set of d squared elements, so they can't be orthogonal. So which is the right limiting form, I don't know.
The point is infinity squared equals infinity. So.
That helps you.
So in infinite dimensions, they could be, you could have the square of the number of dimensions,
but what about
and
infinity
it all be
what? What about infinity cubed?
We'll get to, actually, we'll get to that later in the talk. There's a cube somewhere in it. So what would be the point? Well, why would we care whether these things exist? Well, what most of the talk today is going to be about is that if they exist, they would provide a very nice basis on the space of operators, one with some very nice properties. So you might think of a very nice basis in terms of providing a very nice coordinate system for Hilbert space. Now, what would be the use of providing a very nice coordinate system? Well, sometimes finding a really good coordinate system is useful for cracking what seems to be a deep conceptual problem. Now, I know nothing about general relativity, but I have read, at least at the Scientific American level, that sometime in the 50s, people were stumped, general relativists were stumped over the question of whether the event horizon of a black hole represented a real singularity in space-time or whether it didn't. The reason there was some question about whether it was a singularity is because the coordinate systems that had been developed for Schwarzschild geometry up to that time consisted of two patches, one on the inside of the event horizon and one on the outside of the event horizon. And they didn't cross the event horizon. So there was no way to see exactly what the behavior of Einstein equations were doing there under the use of that coordinate system. But the story goes that Eddington and Finkelstein came along. You see, I really don't know anything about general relativity because I doubt their coordinate system looked like that.
But Eddington and Finkelstein came along and provided a coordinate system that crossed the event horizon, and one could solve the Einstein equations in that region and see that they remained finite. So by the introduction of a good coordinate system, a deep conceptual problem was solved. And this is what I hope for Seeks. What is the deep conceptual problem? Well, I'm paid here at the Perimeter Institute to think about quantum foundations. And so that's the deep conceptual problem I think it will have some impact on. What is the meaning of this symbol? Much of the debate in quantum foundations can be torn apart into, or much of the various factions in quantum, many of the various factions in quantum mechanics, in quantum foundations, can be separated into two broad groups. Those that take quantum states to be representative of some real physical property of quantum systems, and those who take quantum states to represent an observer or an experimentalist information about something to do with a quantum system. And in that broad categorization, I fall on the side of those who think that quantum states have something to do with information and not properties that are truly inherent in the physical systems. But if I take that point of view, then I have to ask myself, if I'm going to be honest, why is it that these statements of our information, more generally density operators, these, well, here I call them a catalog of uncertainties, why do they obey the mathematical structure that we suppose in quantum mechanics? So we say a density operator contains all the information we can have about a quantum system. And what it means to be a density operator is that it's an element of the linear vector space of operators acting on some complex Hilbert space of dimension D. And it satisfies these properties that its permission is trace one, its eigenvalues are non-negative. Why that structure? Why does that capture our information? Why isn't it some other structure, something that looks completely different, is the sort of foundational question that someone like me has to address. Well, how could I address that? And the way that strikes me as the best path is to take some structure that we know of that certainly represents information, namely probability theory, classical probability theory, construed in at least the Bayesian way, where one says that this number, the probability of H, represents my uncertainty or my expectation for H. What I'd like to do is find some mapping from quantum states to probability distributions so that I can say, look, here's quantum mechanics, and I've put it into a common language for addressing these foundational questions from this point of view. So that's what I'm seeking. I'm trying to find some kind of structure that will allow me to map quantum states into probability distributions in a way that's not too very ugly. So how am I going to do that? How am I going to introduce a structure? Here, for John Smolin, is an example of a transparency that is really old. This one is probably 6 years old. Not too smudgy. It's in Paris. And for the first time, I presented this in Paris last week. That was fun. So what I'll do is whenever I'm considering a quantum system, say the one where my finger is, and I usually talk in the terms of it having some quantum state rho, what I want to do instead is imagine that in Paris at the Bureau of Standards, not only is there the standard kilogram and the standard meter, but there's also something that I'll take to be the standard quantum measurement device. And in place of the quantum state for this system, I'll now simply talk in terms of what would happen. So it's in a conditional form. What would go click up in the Bureau of Standards if I were to take this quantum system up into the Bureau of Standards and drop it into this standard measurement device? So in place of the quantum state rho, I want to put a probability distribution for the various possible clicks that this device can have. Now, I'd like to do this in such a way that there's one measurement device up here. not a set of complementary measuring devices, but one measurement device in particular. And the reason I want to do that is that I want to get rid of this kind of interpretational burden that one usually encounters of trying to make a distinction between quantum states on the one hand, these mathematical objects, and probability distributions that they generate on the other hand. So I'd like to find some way of saying, well, this thing, this quantum state, is not prior to the probability assignment. It just is a probability assignment.
That somehow these quantum states have some large classical label called their dimension, which is floating around near them. I mean, do you have a family of standard measurements indexed by D, and you have to make some choice of which measurement device to drop it into?
But I am imagining that. I'm imagining that just like you imagine that an electron has a mass and it has a charge, I'm imagining there's some intrinsic number called its dimension associated with it. And so this thing called the standard measurement device doesn't work for all possible systems. It just defines what I mean by the quantum state of this electron.
It takes the state and its dimension as input, and drops it into a little subroutine, which then does the correct.
It takes the dimension as the input, and then states will be probability distributions.
Okay,
that's right. Now the reason I want to do this is because it helps me put this whole thing into terms that only about two or three of you will even connect with, and that is a Bayesian view of probabilities. I want to get away from this way of thinking about the probabilities as being something that are generated from quantum states, and instead think of them in terms of, well, these are just someone's degrees of belief about what will happen up there. And if I make any other probability assignments, for instance, what are the probabilities of the outcomes of some other measurement? See, this measurement looks different than that, or at least it's meant to. This has four clicks. This one has three. It's a different kind of measuring device. What I'd like to say is, I calculate my probabilities for the outcomes of this other measurement device, not because in the background there's this other thing called the quantum state, but rather I use these old probabilities that I've used for something else to calculate my probabilities for what would happen in this device. In other words, I take the point of view that I'm not dealing with there's this object from which I calculate all probabilities, but instead that what the Born rule is representing is some kind of notion of coherent gambling between various possible experiments. And if I considered a different measurement device still, then again, I would calculate my probabilities for the outcomes of this other measurement directly from my probabilities for the outcomes of this measurement up there. So that's kind of the motivational philosophy. Let me now go toward the mathematical part of this. What I want to do is find a general description of what I can put up in the Bureau of Standards and give some criterion for what would be a good measurement to put up in here. Well, what do I need? I need to satisfy the property of informational completeness. And I'm not sure who invented that term, but here's the point. Quantum states are assumed to be linear operators on this vector space. Well, that, again, is a linear vector space. If this Hilbert space is of dimension D, then the linear operators will live in a linear vector space of dimension D squared. Suppose I can choose a POVM with precisely D squared outcomes, and all of the operators in it are linearly independent. Suppose I can do that. Then the elements of the POVM will represent a basis for this space, a complete basis for the space. Now, if I just notice that the function of the Born rule is to take the projection of the density operator onto these elements, in other words, this is the inner product, the Hilbert-Schmidt inner product between two operators, then I just note that these probabilities uniquely determine the quantum state. So for any such set of operators, I can make them the standard quantum measurement device for my Bureau of Standards.
and that would be good for me in principle. So there, I just identify one. It can be done. There are constructions all over the place for how to do this. You just choose one and you make it the Bureau of Standards Measurement. And once you've done that, then you can stop thinking of quantum states now as elements of this complex vector space and start thinking of them as elements of the probability simplex. So I've got a mapping from quantum states to probability distributions of a certain size. And the quantum state now simply becomes a point on this simplex. It's the analog of a regular tetrahedron in higher dimensions that's just specified by all of the points summing to one and all of them being non-negative. But not all the points in that simplex are possible.
There's a restriction.
I see.
So the mapping, once you introduce the Bureau of Standards mapping, it's one-to-one, but it's not onto. So there are regions. Now, the space of quantum states is a convex set, and you've got a linear mapping. So it will take the set of quantum states thought of as elements of this complex vector space. When we map it into here, it will take that convex set and map it into a convex set on the inside of the simplex. Now, I draw this region as if it's nicely behaved, like it's an ellipsoid in this picture. One should not adopt that picture. In two dimensions, it looks like an ellipsoid always. But in higher dimensions, it is not an ellipsoid, something more complicated. So now the question arises, which Bureau of Standards should be chosen so that this shape that's ultimately going to be something really nasty and jagged and have cusps and all different sorts of things. Which measurement should be chosen so as to make this shape algebraically simple as possible? Well, let's think about that. Suppose I did introduce one of these informationally complete measurements. That's a set of operators with d squared elements, and they're all linearly independent. Then, as I've already shown you, the probabilities for the various outcomes completely determine the quantum state rho. But also, we can just use this as a basis to expand our density operator rho. So let me just do that. What are these expansion coefficients, alpha j, in terms of the probabilities for the outcomes, j? Well, you can work that out trivially. Just calculate the probability of outcome j. You plug in e sub j into the Born rule, and then you use the supposed expansion. But what that means is that the vector p is related to the vector alpha according to some linear transformation, whose elements are just the inner products of the p of m elements. So if you want the alphas to put in here, you just invert this matrix. It's invertible because of the nature of the mapping. And there you go. You can calculate the alphas in terms of the p's. So you might think, well, it would be really nice to choose an informationally complete measurement such that that matrix M is diagonal. That would be nice, because it would make this relationship very simple. I wouldn't have to hardly do any kind of calculation. Well, it turns out that you cannot make this a diagonal matrix and still have this be the kind of operator we're talking about. The closest you can come is kind of putting it in a semi-diagonal form. I don't know exactly what you would call this, but instead of having ones down the diagonal and zeros everywhere else, you have some constant value going down the diagonal and some other constant value in all other entries. Let me show you an example of one with this prettiest form. Let this, what is this, h of hd, let that be the real vector space of permission operators. So let these guys be the permission operators on our Hilbert space. And let me consider the d squared minus one dimensional subspace of trace-free operators. So I just put this linear constraint on it. Then that subspace is a linear vector space. And within within that subspace, let me just pick the unit sphere surrounding the origin and take some points on it, namely ones that lie on this unit sphere. And let me choose the points so that they lie on, that they form a regular simplex themselves. I can always do that. So I've got a set of trace-free operators that geometrically look like the vertices of a simplex. Well, if I just now add some identity back to these guys, this actually is a trick I learned from Peter Shore when I was a young guy, then I end up with a positive operator if I just choose this number to be small enough. So here I've got a set of operators satisfying this nice symmetry condition, and they're informationally complete because if they satisfy this condition, then they'll be linearly independent, and they'll give the matrix M this nice form. So there, is that the foosball table? I hope that's the foosball table. Oh, the soccer game. Actually, we could adjourn. But then you wouldn't think about this problem. So if all you're demanding is a kind of symmetry condition on the operators, then there's an existence proof right there. But this question of Caves was a little different. He didn't demand just simply that we had a symmetric set of operators, but the question was, can we find rank one operators, not operators that are very close to the identity, really noisy density operators, but instead pure states. Then I'm just repeating what I said on the previous slide. If you demand the symmetry condition, then you can prove just from the symmetry condition that these have to be linearly independent, and in fact they'll sum to the identity. So if this set of d squared projectors exists, then they define a good quantum measurement that can be used in the Bureau of Standards. The probabilities for the outcomes of such a measurement will be generated according to the Born rule, and if you use the inversion formula that we worked out a while ago, then you'll find this nice way of expressing density operators in terms of probabilities. So that's one kind of motivation for considering this, is just the simplicity of this formula. But I showed you on the previous transparency that basically anything with the right symmetry, even if they're not rank one, would have an expansion at least roughly along these lines. What is special about these rank one guys? Well, what we're really seeking here, it seems, is a way of drawing an analogy for density operators to what we usually do with pure quantum states. We are accustomed to writing pure quantum states as superpositions of elements drawn from an orthogonal basis. It seems like what we would really like to do is the same thing for density operators, where these operators, again physical states, live in an orthonormal basis. Can you do that? Well, you can't. You can't do that. You're stuck with having non-orthogonal A sub I if you demand that these be density operators themselves. And one easy way to see it, well, no, there's an even easier way to see it, but one quantitative way to see that you can't do that is to suppose that you have a set of operators AI that are all positive semi-definite, and you have d squared of them. And suppose that they're all normalized. Then you can define a quantity that I'm going to call the orthonormality of the set. And what I mean by that is take the inner product between any two elements drawn from this set, any two distinct elements, square the inner product and sum that over all possible combinations. If you could make this set of AI be orthonormal, then of course this quantity would just be zero. But it turns out you can prove a lower bound on the quantity just by using the Schwarz inequality a couple of different times. So you do just a little bit of stuff. You prove a lower bound on it. And if you go back and check the conditions for equality in your chained use of the Schwarz inequality, You'll find, for one thing, that the AIs have to be rank 1 for cheesy quality here. But moreover, they have to satisfy the symmetry condition that we were talking about previously. So what this means is these operators that Caves had asked whether they exist, if they do exist, then by this notion of orthonormality, they come as close to an orthonormal set in the space of density operators as can be allowed. This, I think, gives them an independent independent mathematical interest, because we're not assuming the symmetry at the outset. It becomes now a result, and they seem like a very basic structure in Hilbert space if they do exist. What else makes them special? Well, you can prove some other things, and I'll just give a quick summary here. If you have such a set of pure states, then there's a sense in which you can show that they're maximally sensitive to eavesdropping under intercept and resend strategies. Andrew Scott has shown that they're optimal for some notions of optimality for quantum tomography. And in prime dimensions, so now this is a specialized result, so it's not in general dimensions, but in prime dimensions, you know that you can equip the Hilbert space with a complete set of mutually unbiased bases. You can also do that in prime power dimensions, but I only know this result for sure in prime dimensions. So in those cases, you can equip the space with a complete set of mutually unbiased bases, and you can now create a notion of what is a minimum uncertainty state with respect to such a set of mutually unbiased bases. So you start with a quantum state, and you start with one of the bases in the complete set, and you tabulate the Renyi entropy, Renyi order 2 entropy, for instance, of this quantum state for these measurement outcomes. And then tabulate the Renyi order 2 entropy for a different set. I mean, for a different element of the complete set of mutually unbiased bases. And you do it for all of them. And if you add up all of these Renyi 2 entropies and ask for what quantum state will that sum be minimized, it turns out that these seek states, if they exist, will be among the minimum uncertainty states for that. So they seem to be special in some way or other. Do they exist? Well, that's the big question. And as I've already said, I'm not going to really address it today. But what I want to show you is a little bit more about how they might be useful within quantum foundations and how they might be thought of as giving a good coordinate system for representing quantum states. So we go back to Peter Shor's question, which was this mapping, whenever you have an informationally complete set, is 1-to-1, but it's not onto. So there'll be some kind of region associated, some kind of region within the simplex associated with the valid quantum states. If you can characterize the extreme points of this set, then you've characterized the whole region, just by taking the convex hull of it. Let's see if we can see a nice way of expressing that. All we need to do is start with the notion of what would be an extreme point here, and then map it into terms of probabilities. Well, there are some well-known characterizations of extreme points. So for instance, you might say, well, I have a pure state if and only if it can be written as an exterior product of a state vector with itself. Or you might say, well, I know I have an extreme point if I have some Hermitian operator that's idempotent and has trace 1, so forth. Well, Jones and Linden and Steve Flamia here showed a still nicer characterization, I think. And I've told many of you this story before, but it's worth repeating. I've gotten in the habit of calling this the remarkable theorem. And the reason I call it the remarkable theorem is not because of the difficulty of proving this characterization, but I think it's remarkable in that it appears not to have been observed by many, if anyone, before a few years ago. Somehow it just fell through the cracks of mathematical physics. The theorem is this. Suppose that A is Hermitian. So I'm not requiring that it be positive semidefinite. I'm just requiring that it be Hermitian. Then A can be written as, or A is, a one-dimensional projector if and only if trace A squared equals trace A cubed equals 1. When I first saw that, it really shocked me, because I had always thought that the first thing that one must assume in talking about projection operators is that they be positive semi-definite. And that's not an easy thing to characterize. And here we find that we can characterize one-dimensional projectors in terms of two scalar equations. Well, I think it surprised a lot of people, because I've gone around the world asking people like Lindblad, did you know this thing? And Lindblad didn't.
I asked Elliot Lieb if he knew this theorem, and he said no.
Chris, that might be in Ballantyne's textbook, actually, as a characterization of states.
Is that true?
Yeah. I'm pretty sure.
Really? Well, so he would. I with everyone that I have not found one person yet who said, yeah, I knew that. So he may be the only one. That's cool. Well, here's a proof of the theorem. I love it so much, I'm just going to show it to you. So how would you prove it? Well, we know that it's Hermitian, so let these little ai's be the eigenvalues. And well, trace A squared is just the sum of the eigenvalues squared.
Well, what does that imply? That immediately implies that the eigenvalues are all bounded above by the absolute values of the eigenvalues bounded above by 1, and consequently 1 minus the eigenvalue is greater than or equal to 0. So now we take our two equations, trace A squared equals 1, trace A cubed equals 1, subtract the two from each other. That means the subtraction equals 0. We can now rewrite this as the sum over I of AI squared times 1 minus AI. But this is non-negative, and this is non-negative. So the only way to make that 0 is for the AIs to equal 0 identically, or 1 identically, and then use this condition to say that it is 1 for 1 and only 1 eigenvalue. So what do you do with that? Well, you go back to the little representation formula for quantum states in terms of seeks, and just simply plug it into the equation. I can't find it. But you just plug it back into the equation. And what do you find? You just plug it into there. Well, the first one translates into this very simple condition that is the analog of a Bloch sphere. If you're a pure state in this language, then you're a probability distribution living on the surface of a sphere. The cubic equation doesn't clean up so very nicely, but on the other hand, I think it's a deeper equation. So if you insert the representation into this one, you get that some kind of cubic form created from the probabilities must equal a constant value. And this really is a 7. I presented this once in front of Charlie Bennett, and he said, is that 7? And I said, yes, and he said, that's the first 7 I've ever seen in quantum information. Joseph's student checked it a couple of weeks ago, and he found a 6. And it scared the hell out of me for a while. But he made a mistake. It really is 7. And he admitted it. So anyway, this equation, the cubic equation, becomes this one. Now, in this one, there appears some, all of the structure of the seeks fall out of this. There's no information left about the seeks. But in this one, we take the real part of the trace of the triple product of these guys. Well, what's significant about that? Well, in the foundational game, you always wonder, where does quantum mechanics come from? And for whatever reason that I won't really go into at this conference, the people who play this game say, oh, I don't understand Hilbert space. But suppose God came down to me and said, here's the convex set on the probability simplex, and here's its shape. Somehow we find that more satisfying. So I imagine that God comes down from heaven, and he says, here are these two equations. And he supplies me with these numbers, C, J, K, L, without supplying me with the right side. He just gives me that. And I say, oh, look at that. What do I do with it? Well, one thing you can do with it is you can say, isn't it interesting that a symmetric free tensor crops up in this equation? What could I do with a symmetric free tensor? Well, one thing you might do, Stephen Van Enck would have said, that's an affine connection, and you should use it as an affine connection. Another thing that you might do, I had to ask you what that meant. Another thing you might do is say, where I have numbers of that form, I might be able to prove a representation theorem and define the notion of product. So suppose I'm given these guys. Well, for instance, we could define a Jordan product, the anti-commutator of these two guys in these terms. Well, for consistency's sake, with the usual anti-commutator, it turns out that these structure coefficients are just simple functions of the CIJK on the previous transparency. So this kind of indicates that we might actually be able to go in the opposite direction, not start from Hilbert space, prove the existence of seeks, and then get some expression of the subset of the probability simplex that we're dealing with, but instead start with the subset on the probability simplex and work our way back to some kind of algebraic structure on with which to represent this funny shape. Let me show you a couple of other things that turn out to be interesting. Suppose that we want to write what unitary evolution looks like in this kind of language. Does it really get horrible, or does it not look so very bad? So here's the sort of thing that I'm imagining. We start with some density operator rho. And, well, that doesn't hide anything, does it? That doesn't either. I can still see. There. No, it's really blacked out. Hey, and consequently, that's clearer. You notice that? Okay, so you start off with some density operator rho, and suppose that there's some unitary evolution. Well, what we're looking for is to say, well, I've got some mapping from here down to a probability distribution. Similarly, I'll have some mapping from here down to a probability distribution. And of course, this one is determined in terms of that one. And you just plug in the happy representations, and that's what it looks like. So, well, what? When you plug it in, this doubly stochastic matrix pops out at you. So why do I say it's doubly stochastic? Well, if you just look at this, this is a density operator. U pi I, U dagger is a density operator, and pi j is a projection operator, so it's non-negative. And if I sum over I, then it equals 1. If I sum over j, it equals 1. So these QJs are determined in terms of the PIs by the action of a doubly stochastic matrix, and then a little bit of extra magic. And what do I mean by that? That part of it looks like classical stochastic evolution. And then, well, what does unitarity look like? It looks like classical stochastic evolution followed by an extra little transformation. I don't know exactly what that might teach us, but it feels like it might teach us something, because we found a representation, a relatively nice one, of unitary operators in terms of doubly stochastic matrices. Maybe that's good. But let me show you something deeper, at least something that I think fits deeper than that. The whole purpose of going through this exercise, for me, was to see that there's some way of thinking of the Born rule as not something that sets probabilities, but is a rule that tells me how to calculate new probabilities from old probabilities. And you can see how to do that from the expressions pretty trivially. You just plug it in again. So here's the sort of thing that I wanted. I have some new measurement, not my Bureau of Standards measurement, in some quantum state. And I want to calculate the probabilities for the various outcomes of this new measurement. Well, I just plug in the representation, and what I see is that I take my old probabilities, P of I, and I transform them to new according to a nice linear transformation that's given by the inner product of the seek and this other guy. So this starts to move in the direction of the way I want to think about the meaning of the Born probability rule, that it tells me if you have gambled this way on some certain measurement, you should gamble accordingly for some other measurement. But this form doesn't bring that out as cleanly and as nicely as I would like. So let me show you a better way to think of it. Here's what I want to do. I've got a quantum system over here, and I'm going to throw it into this measurement device. This is what I'm really going to do. I'm going to follow the purple path and throw it into this measurement device. This measurement device is just some von Neumann measurement. So what I mean by von Neumann measurement is that the outcomes correspond to the POVM is just of the form of PJ, JJ, where that's an orthonormal set. So here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to throw this quantum system over there. And I want to calculate the probabilities for getting the various outcomes for that measurement. Suppose that these numbers aren't easily available to me. So for instance, maybe somebody, some malicious sort of person in a contest says, well, if you don't calculate the probabilities for this measurement outcome, I'm going to kill you. You better make a calculation. I said, well, tell me the orthonormal set we're talking about and give me the density operator, and I'll do it. But this malicious person says, no, I'm not going to do that. Here's what I will do. I will give you the probabilities for the various outcomes of some seek, but I'm not going to tell you which seek I'm talking about. So, well, I say, well, that's nice to have those probabilities, P of I, but that still doesn't help me reconstruct the quantum state down here because I don't know which seek that person has introduced. And they will also give me the probabilities of getting the various outcomes J here, given that I got an outcome I at the seeks, at the seek up in the sky. So this is the real measurement I'm going to perform. This one's just an imaginary one. So the malicious person says, well, if it had come out from here and went down here, then it would give you the outcomes J according to these probabilities. And if you throw it up here, it'll give you the outcomes I according to these probabilities. Can you calculate the probabilities for down here? Well, if you believe that quantum mechanics has something to do with interference, then you would be inclined to think, well, it's probably not possible to calculate the things I really need from the given bits of data. Or at least that was my first inclination. Well, what would it be? Let me just ask this question. What would it be if I had thrown the thing up here and then thrown it down? Well, we know from classical probability theory how to do that. Suppose that HI are various hypotheses that one might have, and the DJs represent values of some data that we might take. And suppose that we're given these two things that I was talking about before. What expectations should we adopt for the DJ? Well, we just use the law of total probability. And we all know this. We were all taught this when we were very young. When we come to this quantum case, though, we're not actually going up this route and that route where we would have used the formula I just showed you. We're going directly this way. Well, nicely enough, for the seeks, you can calculate what you need to calculate. And it's just a minor variation on the old formula. In fact, what you do is you take the old formula of total probability and then merely modify it slightly with an extra factor in the front. And then for normalization purposes, you have to subtract off a little bit. What does this tell us? This is probably not the audience to really explain what I think it does tell us, but because you'll throw tomatoes at me. But I think what it tells us is, in a different language, something that has been part of the foundational debate for ages, And that is, does a measurement reveal a pre-existing but unknown value of some observable, or does it, in some sense, go toward creating the value? In the kind of reasoning that goes on in the old Bayesian formula, the way these various terms, I'm also running out of time, so I'm not going to go very deeply into it, but the origin of these terms are defined in terms of the way an agent would gamble. And in particular, P of DJ given HI is always written in terms of conditional bets. So I can bet on an event H, and I can bet on an event D. And I might ask myself, how would I gamble on H and D? And we write down a probability distribution for H and D. That represents how one gamble. But then you can also ask, well, how would you gamble under a conditional bet situation, where you first see if H occurs, and if the right H occurs, then you go on to the next step of the gambling situation. And if the proper H doesn't occur, you call it off and you get your money back. This is the way conditional probabilities are defined in that subject. And what's crucial for that is the idea that the intermediate experiment has actually occurred. In this quantum case, what we're doing is comparing an experiment that we're going to do one way with a situation where we force a conditional gambling situation. So I tend to think that this formula is rather deep and somehow expresses something that we've only seen before when we've talked about Cauchy-Specker theorems, for instance. So finally, you ask, well, why did I give the title to the talk that I did? The question is, how might we use SEECS to better axiomatize quantum theory? And I'm guessing that the deep content of quantum theory is in this deviation from the classical law of total probability. And in particular, I won't talk about it now, but in particular, if you massage this equation enough, you'd be surprised how much of the shape of the convex set that represents quantum states you can find from demanding that this probability be between 0 and 1. So I'll end, and I just hope, ultimately, that you'll use part of this week to think sick thoughts and try to learn or make some statements about the structure, whether they exist and whether all of this is fantasy land, or whether they don't exist and all of this is fantasy land, or whether they do exist and then there's some chance of understanding quantum mechanics in terms of them. Thanks.